couple arrived yesterday, and he and I have just had a long talk at lunch, in the course of which he made my hair stand on end with his tales of the new scientific developments on which he has been working. Clearly taken by Lovell's ideas, Bruce continued, "Lovell's arrival has been anxiously awaited, and I have put him in touch immediately with various people at SOE who are engaged in similar work. One of the most forward-thinking projects undertaken by Lovell's team was Java Man, a remote-controlled weapon consisting of a boat packed with 4 tons of explosives. Using early television technology, a camera mounted on the boat's bow broadcast images to a plane circling 50 miles away, where a crew member watching a monitor guided the boat to its destination, then triggered the explosives by remote control. Despite encouraging tests, the project was eventually dropped. According to Lovell, the Navy abandoned the idea because it judged the explosive load as too dangerous to carry either by ship or submarine. By the summer of 1944, with bases of operations established throughout the world, OSS printed a Sears and Roebuck-style catalog of espionage and sabotage devices, listing the specifications of each piece of equipment, along with pictures. Station chiefs could peruse the catalog and choose whatever device they required. At war's end in 1945, OSS had produced, in less than 36 months after its creation, more than 25 special weapons and dozens of sabotage devices, along with scores of other gadgets, including concealments, radios, and escape and evasion tools. Mirroring the accelerated wartime production schedules that turned out ships, canteens, boots, and bombs in record time, it was a remarkable achievement. With initial guidance from the British, the OSS progressed in 2 years from offering a handful of basic tools of the spy trade to the design, manufacture, and deployment of an astonishing array of devices. The OSS Officer Corps developed at a similar frenetic pace, establishing intelligence networks throughout Europe, the Middle East, and Asia. Yet, in the autumn of 1945, the fruits of America's dramatic entry into the international spy game were nearly lost in the wake of America's rapid military demobilization. Chapter 2. We Must Be Ruthless. We cannot afford methods less ruthless than those of our opposition. John le Carré, The Spy Who Came In from the Cold. With the end of the war growing near, Donovan remembered the lessons of Pearl Harbor and the value of intelligence in occupied Europe and other theaters of war. At the behest of President Roosevelt, he prepared a detailed memorandum calling for the creation of a permanent post-war agency to act as a central clearinghouse for intelligence. In the covering letter of this 1944 memo, Donovan wrote, "When our enemies are defeated, the demand will be equally pressing for information that will aid us in solving the problems of peace." However, Washington politics during the last days of World War II eroded Donovan's influence, along with his dream of forming a civilian Central Intelligence Service. Many in government considered the OSS a temporary wartime agency, not needed in peacetime any more than the Office of Price Administration, which oversaw the rationing of sugar and car tires. For them, espionage was an inconvenient wartime necessity, like gas coupons and war bond drives. Unable to see future challenges to national security, they believed America's involvement in spying should end with the war. Donovan's memo, intended for the private consideration of the President and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was leaked to the press. Columnist Walter Trohan, leading the charge against a standing intelligence agency, wrote in February 1945 in the Chicago Tribune and the New York Daily News, "Creation of an all-powerful intelligence service to spy on the post-war world and to pry into the lives of citizens at home is under serious consideration by the New Deal. The unit would operate under an independent budget and presumably have secret funds for spy work along the lines of bribing and luxury living described in the novels of E. Phillips Oppenheim." This was a direct policy and class attack on Donovan and his blue-blooded operatives, even down to the mention of Oppenheim. A popular and prolific British spy novelist of the day, Oppenheim pioneered the genre that would eventually become known as the international thriller, rarely missed an opportunity to have his characters revel in extravagant luxury. The message was clear. Spying was elitist, unsavory, and un-American. After Donovan's confidential report remained unacted on by Roosevelt, a second negative report made its way to President Truman's desk. This one, prepared by a Roosevelt aide, Colonel Richard Park Jr., offered a devastating review of the OSS, and with it, Donovan's proposed peacetime intelligence agency. Truman accepted Park's position and wasted no time acting. Within weeks of VJ Day in mid-August, the president signed an order on September 20, 1945, abolishing OSS and directing it to disband by October 1, 1945. Providing only 10 days for the dissolution of the agency, the executive order left no time for a political counteroffensive by Donovan and OSS supporters. 2 days prior to its official termination, the OSS staff gathered in Washington at the Rock Creek Park Drive skating rink, near the present-day Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, to bid farewell to one another. Addressing the assembled crowd, Donovan said, "We have come to the end of an unusual experiment." This experiment was to determine whether a group of Americans constituting a cross-section of racial origins, of abilities, temperaments, and talents could risk an encounter with the long-established and well-trained enemy organizations. Closing down of OSS did not completely dissolve its capabilities. Bits and pieces of the organization were seen as valuable and absorbed into other government entities. Research and analysis was moved to the State Department, and other sections were incorporated into the War Department, later the Department of Defense, under the name Strategic Services Unit. Those transferred included overseas OSS stations and a skeleton crew from operations and technical support made up of a few experts in wireless communications, agent documentation, and secret writing, SW. However, the majority of OSS engineers, scientists, and craftsmen assembled for wartime duty returned to the private sector, taking with them their expertise in producing the specialized equipment required for intelligence operations. America was without a functioning centralized intelligence agency, though not for long. In January of 1946, 2 months before Winston Churchill warned of the coming Soviet challenge in his historic Iron Curtain speech in Fulton, Missouri, President Truman signed the Central Intelligence Group, CIG, into existence. The occasion became a jovial ceremony where attendees were supplied black cloaks, black hats, and wooden daggers. The CIG's two basic missions were strategic warning and the coordination of clandestine activities abroad. Absorbing the Strategic Services Unit, along with its officers, agents, files, overseas stations, and unvouchered funds, the new agency's overseas component was named the Office of Special Operations, OSO, with responsibilities for foreign intelligence, counterintelligence, covert action, and technical support. However, without independent funds, the CIG did not function well, and within the first year and a half, had 3 directors. With the Cold War intensifying, and with the CIG underperforming, government leaders recognized that without independent statutory authority, the structure could not carry out the required mission. As a response, Congress passed the National Security Act of 1947 that created the Central Intelligence Agency. Like the CIG, the new agency focused on providing early warning and preparation for any Soviet invasion of Western Europe. On the military front, weapons were cached, agents infiltrated into Eastern European countries, stay-behind resistance groups organized, and plans for counterattacking Soviet invaders drawn up. The more traditional job of spying fell to the OSO, which had been absorbed into the CIA intact. With more than one-third of its officers drawn from the OSS, the OSO proved effective, but technical support could not keep up with operational demands. As a result, in September 1949, OSO created an Operational AIDS Division, staffed by officers with prior experience in OSS Cover and Documentation Division. The operational aids included agent authentication and documentation papers, secret writing, photography, and audio surveillance. A year earlier, in September 1948, a separate organization known as the Office of Policy Coordination, OPC, was formed to conduct aggressive paramilitary and psychological warfare operations against the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. Between 1948 and 1952, OPC grew from 302 employees with no overseas stations to a staff of more than 2,800 staff and 40 overseas stations. OPC had its own small R&D shop and staff, inherited from OSS, that conducted research in chemistry, applied physics, and mechanics. The two offices operated independently and competed for the limited resources available to produce the clandestine devices needed by agents and officers. With little quality control and without a coordinated research and development program, early CIA technical equipment was often in short supply and of uneven quality. In October of 1950, President Truman, dissatisfied with the CIA's intelligence following North Korea's invasion of South Korea, appointed General Walter Beadle Smith as Director of Central Intelligence. Smith, in turn, appointed Alan Dulles head of clandestine operations, giving him the title Deputy Director for Plans, DDP, in 1951. All of the agency's operational components came under the DDP in January 1952. Dulles appreciated the value of technical equipment for clandestine operations through first-hand knowledge. As an OSS case officer, he had used devices supplied by Lovell's R&D branch. He also understood that the CIA faced a problem of applying emerging post-war technologies to improve clandestine gear and deploy the equipment to field operatives. Dulles first turned to Lovell, who had returned to the private sector, for advice in early 1951. The Professor Moriarty of the OSS responded by proposing a centralized technical R&D component within the agency similar to the OSS R&D division. This technical organization, working under the DDP, would develop technology for operations as well as conduct research on new capabilities that might contribute to intelligence gathering. The engineers would understand both the potential of new technology and how to apply it to clandestine requirements. Warfare is no longer a matter of chivalry, but of subversion, Lovell wrote to the man who would dominate U.S. intelligence for the next decade. Subversion has its own special arsenal of tools and weapons. Only research and development is capable of creating such an arsenal. Lovell also advised that a central R&D component for the CIA should begin with a minimum staff of several hundred scientists and engineers. The recommendation found a receptive ear with Dulles, and he assigned his special assistant, Richard Helms, to study the issue of technical support. In turn, Helms tasked Colonel James H. Trapper Drum, then head of the OAD, to produce a report with recommendations that addressed the problem. 4 months later, Drum, a West Point graduate who left the military a full colonel to join the agency, produced a lengthy report that formed the foundation for a new approach to providing operations with technical support. Known as Drum's Bible, the report advised combining all technical elements responsible for supporting operations into a single organization directly under the DDP. Drum wrote to Dulles in August of 1951 that the proposed new office would provide the tools of the trade required to support the operating components of the clandestine service. As Lovell had recommended several months earlier, Drum envisioned a new organization with two primary responsibilities: centralized technical support to deliver gear needed by field operations, and research and development to improve collection capabilities. Dulles accepted the recommendations and created a technical services staff, TSS, with powers and authorities equivalent to those of the other operational offices in the CIA. On September 7, 1951, the DDP formally announced establishment of TSS, a small component numbering about 50 officers, with Drum at its head. Explosive growth followed. Within 2 years, the demand for TSS products and services was so strong that the staff expanded more than fivefold. TSS existed until July of 1960 and then was renamed the Technical Services Division, TSD. It took nearly a decade for Technical Services to gain formal recognition as a DDP division, nomenclature previously reserved for components operating in particular geographic areas. However, before TSD celebrated its second anniversary, it faced the grim reality that the KGB's counterintelligence capabilities far outmatched the ability of the CIA, using World War II tradecraft and technology, to run agents securely inside the USSR. Events that would teach those bitter lessons began promisingly in 1961 with a stream of spectacular intelligence reporting from a senior Soviet military intelligence officer, Colonel Oleg Penkovsky. Section 2. Playing Catch-Up. Chapter 3. The Penkovsky Era. Each man here is alone. Oleg Penkovsky, quoted in the Penkovsky Papers. Bad news, like every secret communication from Moscow, arrived at CIA headquarters encrypted. The news that arrived mid-morning on November 2, 1962, as the Cuban Missile Crisis was winding down, was particularly bad. Colonel Oleg Vladimirovich Penkovsky, a career Soviet military intelligence officer and the agency's most spectacularly successful spy, was, in all likelihood, lost. Penkovsky had held a senior position in the Glavnoye Razvedivatelnoye Upravlenie, GRU, the Chief Intelligence Directorate of the Soviet General Staff, while secretly reporting to U.S. and British intelligence. In the colorful parlance of espionage, he had almost certainly been rolled up. At the new agency compound at Langley, Virginia, the paint was barely dry on the walls when the communications center on the ground floor, headquarters' sole secure link to Moscow personnel, received the super-enciphered message. It arrived as an immediate cable, a long, narrow strip of paper snaking out of a bulky machine, much like a price quote from an old-fashioned stock ticker. The encoded message was contained in an intricate pattern of perforations that ran along the paper's length. When the transmission was complete, the paper was torn off by the communicator and then run through a printer that produced a neat array of seemingly random numbers and letters on a sheet of standard letter-sized paper. A second level of decryption was needed to render the message into plain text. This phase of decryption guarded against the potential for security failures along the transmission path, whether over the air or via landlines. Like placing a strong, small safe inside a larger safe, this last layer of decryption could be performed only by one of a handful of authorized officers from the Soviet Russia Division, SR, of the CIA's Directorate of Plans. Although the DDP sounded like the dullest of bureaucracies, its name veiled the most secretive directorate in the agency. Hidden beneath the vague acronym resided the responsibility for the CIA's cloak-and-dagger work. Within the DDP, SR was particularly shrouded with cloak. If asked about their job by neighbors or friends, SR personnel would repeat a carefully rehearsed cover story of working for one or another government department, but never the CIA. It was not unusual for DDP operations officers to remain undercover even after retirement and maintain their cover stories until their deaths. Even the top-secret clearance required for employment at the agency did not authorize someone to know rudimentary details regarding SR or its personnel. If an agency colleague asked about an SR staffer's job, they would receive only generalized replies, and most knew better than to probe for details. secrecy within the agency was both enforced by official policy and expected as part of professional etiquette. Virtually no one, with the exception of SR personnel, was allowed into SR spaces. A no-nonsense secretary immediately confronted any visitor who opened the unmarked, always closed hallway doors that led into the division suite, and friends of SR officers from other parts of the agency did not drop in to plan weekend activities or for office gossip. When SR officers left the area, even for a short time, security procedures mandated that the desks be cleared and all work secured in one of the division's high-security 500-pound black steel safes. SR Division applied strict need-to-know compartmentation through BIGOT lists that restricted access to what many would consider routine information coming out of the Soviet Union. Within the division, information was distributed like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. Only a very few ever saw an entire operational picture. Those outside of SR could only assume that a puzzle existed. Within CIA's instinctively tight-lipped security environment, SR's added multi-layered security cloak created a mystique that some viewed as arrogant and unnecessarily obsessive. The term BIGOT list existed, and still exists, as a holdover from World War II, when the most prized stamp on the orders of personnel traveling from England to Africa was TOGIB, meaning to Gibraltar. To reach Africa, the majority of personnel made the dangerous journey by ship through seas controlled by German U-boats. However, for a select few, there were the highly prized seats on a flight to Gibraltar. For these lucky individuals, the stamp on their orders was reversed to read BIGOT, and the term thus acquired its special meaning in intelligence circles, carrying with it the inference of not only rarity, but also safe passage and a valued mission. There were other levels of compartmentation as well. A top-secret clearance did not provide automatic access to specific operations or programs. TS, a security clearance level required for all CIA staff employees, only made one eligible for potential access to a compartmented program. The BIGOT access was granted based on responsibilities and an individual's demonstrated need to know about the operation. SR's security policies extended to written communications within headquarters. SR did not rely on the CIA's usual inter-office mail couriers, nor were its officers permitted to use the 1960-era state-of-the-art pneumatic tube system that carried classified documents to every corner of the 1.4 million square foot building. Everything regarding Soviet operations was hand-carried from office to office by either an SR operations officer or one of a dedicated cadre of women known as intelligence assistants. It was standard operating procedure for the communicator to place the encrypted message in a heavy manila security envelope, securely seal it, and call SR to advise that a cable had been received from Moscow. On the morning of November 2nd, the young SR officer who walked to the communications vault accepted the sealed envelope and, without opening it, retraced his 3-minute route to SR's small warren of offices, could not have known that he now had a role in one of history's most significant espionage events. At his desk, the officer opened the envelope, removed the single sheet of paper, and, with painstaking care, began deciphering the message by hand. He used a one-time pad, or OTP, whose printed columns of numbers and letters exactly matched those used by the person who had composed the brief message. After the message was deciphered, the page of the one-time pad used was destroyed. The Soviet Union paid a heavy price during World War II when they reused one-time pad pages for communicating with agents in different parts of the world. This seemingly innocuous error provided an advantage to U.S. codebreakers who were able to unravel many Soviet ciphered communications that had been intercepted from Washington, D.C. and New York City. This secret would become known as Venona and remains one of the notable achievements of the Army Security Agency and later the National Security Agency. The cable did not mention Penkovsky by name. Rather, it reported that Richard Jacob, a CIA officer in Moscow, was apprehended while clearing a dead drop. After a nerve-shattering but relatively brief interrogation, the message continued, Jacob was released to the custody of the U.S. ambassador and returned to the safety of the U.S. embassy. Because he was a diplomat, Jacob could not be formally charged with a crime. Instead, he was PNG'd, declared persona non grata by Soviet authorities, and ordered out of the country. Penkovsky's arrest by the KGB was not confirmed during those first few hours, but it did not seem realistic to hold out much hope for the agent. As in the immediate aftermath of any roll-up, there were more questions than facts, but for those few who knew about the case, it required no imagination to conclude that Penkovsky either was dead or would be very soon. The officer delivered the decrypted cable up the chain of command to the SR division chief. The chief took the bad news to the deputy director for plans, who in turn briefed John McCone, the director of Central Intelligence. Within 24 hours, McCone would personally inform President Kennedy. That so few understood the enormous impact Penkovsky's arrest would have on America's national security was partially due to the extraordinary secrecy surrounding the nearly 18-month operation and the care given to the handling of the remarkable intelligence he single-handedly supplied. Intelligence reports based on Penkovsky's information had been structured to suggest that the intelligence originated from multiple sources. To reinforce this illusion, the Penkovsky product circulated under two code names, Ironbark for that material that was scientific or quantifiable, and Chickadee for material that included his personal observations. For anyone outside the small group who knew the truth, the vast quantity of intelligence flowing from the Soviet Union looked like the work of an extensive spy network, coupled with mysterious and advanced technical collection, rather than the efforts of a single spy. A small team of CIA and British intelligence officers ran Penkovsky. He was alternately known as Hero to his American handlers and Yoga to the British. Jacob had been chosen to service the dead drop because he had recently arrived in Moscow and had a strong cover in a traditionally non-alerting, low-level administrative position. As such, he was less likely to be identified as a CIA officer and draw KGB surveillance. According to later accounts, Jacob entered the dingy hallway of an apartment house at 56 Pushkinskaya and removed an ordinary matchbox wrapped in a short length of wire that formed a hook to secure it behind a radiator. As Jacob was placing the matchbox in his pocket, the KGB team jumped him from their hiding places in the vestibule. During the ensuing scuffle, he managed to drop the matchbox to the floor through a slit in the lining of his raincoat pocket, ridding himself of incriminating evidence and avoiding the nasty legal and diplomatic problems arising from having Soviet state secrets on his person. The technicality did not matter to the KGB team, since it was obvious why the American was in the building. Once subdued, Jacob was hustled into a waiting car and whisked off to a nearby militia station. The final act of the Penkovsky drama had begun that morning with two voiceless phone calls, silent calls, to a phone answered by a U.S. official. The silent call was a signal activating the communication plan issued to Penkovsky by his handlers when they had met outside the Soviet Union. Arguably the most critical piece of any operation, the COMO plan provided agents, such as Penkovsky, with precise contact instructions and schedules to establish secure communication under both ordinary and extraordinary circumstances. Because the CIA assumed that the KGB monitored all telephone calls to and from the U.S. officials, the silent call represented a clever piece of tradecraft that allowed a message to be sent even if the call was monitored. Penkovsky had been instructed to go to a remote public telephone and call a specific number. When the phone was answered, he said nothing, but waited 10 seconds before hanging up. The call to the specific number and the length of silence before hanging up were the message that directed intelligence officers to a telephone pole marked with a symbol written in chalk, an X.